This next story, as we've been talking about stories this morning, is, I think, quite unique. And it came to me through Steve Woods when I first called him about this, and he mentioned what these guys were doing. And I used to work in watershed, so I found it intriguing. But this is the only hour-long presentation that we have today, and there's a reason for that, because they need some time to tell their story. And it's a multi-step history, and it's really talking about how water planning has changed at the watershed level, and we're really talking here about the headwaters of the Mississippi River, which I think is pretty unique. They've done things where they've got the government looking at this and now understanding from the watershed perspective what they can and cannot do in their county. And so it's done that for the county commissioners, and it's also provided some direction for the farmers up there as to where they can and cannot go and how land use should look in order to accomplish lots of different objectives. So I'm going to let them tell the story, but the storytellers are Dan Stewart and Jeff Ruby. How do you pronounce it? Rubis from the Minnesota Board of Water and Soil Resources, and Mitch Brinks is from Crow Wing County. He's the county water planner. Thanks.
Thank you, Don. Thank you for the opportunity to bring a little bit of a different story here. We'll definitely be in that storytelling realm if we can stay there, and it's different because we're talking about protection. That is, protecting water quality where it's still basically good. There's a few impairments in north central Minnesota, other than the mercury impairments, which are common. But by and large, we're talking about a landscape that, because it's largely forested and sandy to a great extent, still has good water quality, and our goal and interest is in keeping it that way if we can. And so with that, we'll get started. I'm just here to provide some context for the Mitch Brinks with Crow Wing County, who's going to follow me and talk about the Crow Wing County Water Plan. And he'll give you context on where Crow Wing County is in the state of Minnesota, for those of you that are out of state. And then Jeff Rubish will finish it off with the what's next, where are we going in the next iteration or the next phase of county water planning. I like to start out with this slide. Americans are good fixers, but we aren't very good preventers. Very well said by Jimmy Doolittle way back in 1940, in the 40s. Our problem here is, you know, we're struggling with human nature. It's human nature to fix things that are broken. I mean, when things get like the tile line that was broke in the middle of harvest and in rain, all of a sudden there's a problem. We're good at rallying to fix those things. And it's not just Americans, I think it's human nature in general to react to things like that. We really struggle, though, with looking far enough ahead down the road to see a problem coming and prevent that problem from developing, or at least limiting the extent to which it develops. This is closely related to another major philosophical point, and that is the myth of superabundancy. Whatever you have a lot of, you're quite likely to take for granted. And so in north central Minnesota, northeastern Minnesota, we have a lot of water, we have a lot of lakes, we have good water quality generally. We're very likely, very prone to take that for granted. And the more you take things for granted, eventually, that bill comes due. And if we allow 10 or 20% of the water resources we're looking at up here to go to the impaired side, we're going to incur costs we can't possibly meet because of the vast scale of the resources we're talking about. Then I look at this slide, and I'll read this. It's kind of low here. I hope everybody can see it. G.W. Curtis of Longview, Washington, uses a slingshot Wednesday to get his sturgeon bait into the Columbia River. Curtis had to watch for passing cars along the Ocean Beach Highway as he stretched the rubber tubing to the limit. That's the part I really like. Curtis uses a railroad spike for a sinker and smelt for bait. So I guess my point here is we need outside-the-box thinking. When we started 10, maybe 15 years ago, there was no water quality protection strategy for Minnesota. And so we needed to develop one. The Clean Water Act had done a tremendous amount of good across the country since its passage, but it was really oriented towards impairments. and it was oriented towards point sources and that sort of thing. And here's Minnesota, Wisconsin, Michigan, some other states. We all have some good waters. I'm not saying otherwise, but they're kind of outliers. We got a lot of good water still, and that wasn't really at the front of the mind when the Clean Water Act was written. So therefore, we need some outside-the-box thinking here if we're going to tackle something as large as this. Now, just to provide a little physical context for, again, for folks outside Minnesota coming into the state, we've simplified this here to divide the state up into three major biomes. We've got the in the green, the dark green, the northeastern lakes and forests area, the transition zone of the red, and then the prairie zone of western Minnesota. Okay, if we look at how these areas differ now, and we're going to more or less focus on the prairie zone and the protection area or forested zone of the state, water quantity is the driver in most of western Minnesota, especially the Red River Valley and the northwestern part of the state, very heavy clay soils. I don't think there's a place in the United States that floods on as regular and as frequent and as large a scale as the Red River Valley of the North does. Because of those clay soils, very little slope, and on top of all that, a northern outlet that's frozen when the south end breaks loose in the spring. So that's a major problem. They're very water quantity oriented, whereas in the forested zone, we're water quality oriented because we've got a lot of lakes. It's a major economic driver. These counties in northeastern Minnesota, tourism is a major element of their economy, along with forestry and mining. We're lake-based. The valley in western Minnesota is much more stream and ditch-based. Again, as I mentioned, we're forest-based. The prairie soils are obviously ag-based. They have heavy soils, and we have light, sandy soils. They have very high land values. Values of $8,000 an acre are relatively common in the prairie part of the state. In our part of the state, I've always said you could buy most of northeastern Minnesota for $1,500 an acre. So we're orders of magnitude cheaper in terms of land value, and looking at conservation, land value is a major input in terms of how much you can accomplish. We have low levels of land disturbance, whereas there's high levels of land disturbance in the restoration or the prairie part of the state. We have lots of public land. Some of the Crow Wing County has a modest amount of county land, only 110,000 acres. Whereas if you go north and east of there, all the counties have higher levels of public land, 50% in Cass and Itasca, up to 90% in the tip of the Arrowhead in far northeastern Minnesota. So big differences there as well. The forested part of the state with its lakes has lots of lake associations. Lake associations are very important from a water quality and a planning perspective because that's our route to data. That's our route to Secchi disk readings that can give us taken over enough years, we can get a water quality trend, and that's one of our major inputs and things that Jeff and Mitch will talk about. So lake associations are a good thing. They tend to be pretty good at collecting data. We have source water issues in the North Central, and just in that, by far the state's largest source water is the Upper Mississippi River, which feeds St. Cloud at in central Minnesota, about 80,000 people or so, I think. That St. Cloud is the first major city on the river to draw its drinking water supply from the river. Minneapolis and St. Paul do as well, so we're talking millions of people just in Minnesota who draw their drinking water from the Great River. And on downstream, I think it's 17 cities or something like that on downstream as it goes. So the major source water area of the state is north central Minnesota, not even northeastern Minnesota, north central Minnesota, or the headwaters of the Mississippi. Okay, then there's a scale issue here. There are a lot of lakes, and when we say that, we're talking about a minimum size of 10 acres and up. And so that upper Mississippi basin there with the counties under shown in green, light green, in the map, are represented on the right there with their number of lakes in each county that exceeds 10 acres. These are numbers that counties can easily get the deer in the headlights look, because, you know, counties are responsible for land use in Minnesota. Counties are cities. And so land use authority, we all know, has a major impact on quality and quantity of water. And so these folks, like it or not, are in the driver's seat in terms of steering much of our future ship in terms of water quality in the north central part of the state. And so states would struggle with managing 650 lakes like Becker County needs to do. And, of course, that's nothing compared to Itasca's 1,000 lakes or Otter Tail's 1,000 lakes. So we're talking about a major scale problem here, which results in, if we're going to tackle this issue of protection, we need something simple and efficient or inexpensive, at least where we are right now. It can grow in sophistication and so on over time, but we need to start with something quick and relatively inexpensive. So now I'm going to give a little programmatic context before we turn it over to Mitch, and that is county water planning in Minnesota is a relatively unique animal, I think, across the country. I don't know how many other states have a statute similar to county water planning. I know back in the mid-80s, no other state did. Let me go into a little more background here. 1976 was a severe drought. Some of the rivers in Minnesota recorded zero flow. They actually dried up. There was no flow in the base flow. As a result of that, the legislature, all kinds of problems started to bubble up to the level of the legislature. And so they established the Water Planning Board, a cross-section of citizens, government, nonprofits, everybody basically from across the state. They studied water management in Minnesota, came back to the legislature in 1979 with their report. Toward Efficient Allocation and Management was the title of that report. 80 recommendations on how water management in the state could be improved. One of those was, you know, we all know that land use affects quality and quantity of water, and yet the main land use holder in Minnesota, the counties, water's one of the many, they're general purpose local units of government. They handle everything from the sheriff's department to social services, to the libraries, and all, you know, it highways. It's very, very broad and often thin, especially when it comes to the area of water. It's just another thing on their agenda. It's usually on the back burner until there's some kind of a crisis. What if we could get counties to put water planning on the front burner, water management on the front burner? And we would do that by encouraging them, not requiring them, but encouraging them to write county water plans. So the statute actually passed in 1985, and we have about 30 years of experience now in writing county water plans in Minnesota. They're updated every 5 years, and Mitch's talk will focus on the last update of the Crow Wing County water plan. Okay, so we've got these five-year updates of water planning coming along every 5 years, 1990, 1995, 2000, 2005, and you know, water planning was now, it's 20 years old. We've done 3-4 generations of water planning. It's kind of becoming the same old, same old. And some of us were saying, you know, if we don't reinvigorate water planning, pretty soon it's going to die, and we're going to lose a great tool because it's resulted in all kinds of good things happening in the state in regard to water management. The plans were mainly policy plans. Just to give you a quick example, it's simple and it's obvious, but the water plan gave the counties a place to say, you know, non-conforming septic systems aren't good. They tend to be bad on surface water, our lakes, and they're also tough for the human health impacts they can cause with shallow wells. So you know what? Let's get our non-conforming septic systems in this county upgraded, and let's start a major campaign to do that, and so on. And that resulted in thousands and thousands of septic upgrade projects. Counties also adopted about that time time of transfer ordinances. So when the property transfers, you have to have a certificate of compliance on your septic system. If you don't, you can't transfer the property until you get one or escrow the money. So those sorts of things incrementally over time, simple policy plans, resulted in some great steps forward. Okay, then this thing happened called the 2008 Constitutional Referendum. in the state. It was put on the ballot after about 10 years of effort to get it on the ballot. It finally made it to the ballot. Should the sales tax in Minnesota be increased 0.375% for three funds, one habitat, one clean water, and one a combination of parks, trails, and arts. The recession had just happened. The Great Recession had just happened. Speaking just for myself, I didn't think it had a chance. Most people I knew didn't think it had a chance. And lo and behold, it passed easily. Even though no vote on it, not checking either box, was a no vote. So it started with a, got to be a 5% headwind, I would think. It still passed easily. So that was quite a statement as to where the people of the state were in their thinking about conservation. But I've heard before some of the old-timers have said that in the worst of times economically is sometimes when you get the greatest achievements in the legislature for conservation, because people are reminded by what's really important and fundamental. And water certainly is one of those things. So in 2008, the referendum passed, resulting in a great infusion of funding that was just amazing, unforeseen, unexpected, and, of course, very welcome. So over the time, we started to benefit from these referendum funds, and we started working to re-energize county water planning. We started this process called lake screening to deal with these hundreds and hundreds of lakes that are in a single county and in various stages of health. And Mitch will talk about that as well as Jeff. And then we, after doing a lot of lake screening, we thought, well, you know, if we can screen lakes and their minor watershed that they're in, maybe we should try screening all the minor watersheds in the county. And that's where the Crow Wing County Water Plan came in and took up that challenge. So in 2013, we arrived at this thought of, again, echoing that original Torrey Efficient Allocation and Management report from the Water Planning Board way back in 1979. How about toward a comprehensive coordinated clean water protection strategy? It's fine. We're going to do a lot of work on impairments in this state. There's no question about that. But we can't just do impairments or we're going to lose the ball game because we've got too many waters at stake up north, as we say. So with that, I'll turn it over to Mitch.
Thanks, Dan. One of the things that you know, as a water planner or a planner in general, you want to make sure that when you're putting this thing together, it actually gets used. You know, there's a lot of plans that, you know, when I took over in 2009 as the water planner in my county, you know, there's a lot of plans that just sat on the shelf. And I'm like, what are we even doing with this? Does anybody even know what's in this plan? And so we kind of went through an inventory at the county and you know, what kind of started our water plant update was we had just adopted some land use performance standards and a brand new land use ordinance, won some awards at the state level. And so we're like, well, let's try to integrate as many of these plans, simplify them all, and achieve, hopefully, a desired result. So that was kind of the driver of our water plan rewrite. And we were also aware at the same time of all these other entities that had projects, you know, monitoring data going on, PCA out there with water quality, groundwater, working with the Department of Ag, Department of Health. So we wanted to integrate as many of these, you know, existing data sets into our plan as we could. Dan and Jeff from Bowser provided a lot of, you know, the context and background to help us along the way. And one of the things that shouldn't get lost in all this is, you know, this is a locally adopted policy document, you know. This is kind of guides the future for the next 10 years of, you know, Crow Wing County's water management. It was in front of the county board. We had stakeholder input. It wasn't something that staff just put together. It was something that, you know, locally all the county commissioners had to sign off on, with the goal then of leading toward implementation, prioritized targeted measurement, measured implementation. I'm going to skip over this one quick. As Dan mentioned, kind of the first thing that we looked at was what data do we have available that can help assist in this plan. And we had gotten a grant back in 2008 to look at some of our largest lakes. We decided, well, let's start here. We have, you know, about 13, maybe 16 lakes if you include some of the border lakes that are over 1,000 acres. Let's at least start there and just see what we can find out from all these lake associations that have been collecting data. Data's probably sitting in a box or down at St. Paul here somewhere in a storage locker. Let's pull that out and see what it tells us. And so that's kind of what we started with again, because there was that likelihood for these large lakes to have data. We didn't have too many state-level documents that could help us out back at this time in history. And so we found that to be helpful, and we actually expanded it in 2012, 2013, and then earlier this year as well. So now we have a report for all of our lakes that are 200 acres on up. And what we kind of found is a little bit surprising maybe to the normal way of thinking. You know, a lot of folks say, well, everything's just going to heck in a handbasket, you know, and really we found that's not the case. About a third of our lakes were declining, but most of them were stable or even improving in terms of water quality based on the information that we had available over these long-term trends. And so this, again, kind of was one of the key pieces of our protection model was, okay, you know, how do we protect these waters that are still in good shape? In these reports, it also looked at the lake shed, or the area that directly kind of contributed into those waters. And it kind of broke it down into a number of different categories, looking at how much is public, how much is open water, and how much is wetland. And can we call that kind of protected infrastructure already? If it's publicly owned, generally it's being managed to maintain a high-quality resource. If it's open water, that's already protected. And wetlands in the state of Minnesota are protected by the Wetland Conservation Act, which prevents filling and draining. So that was kind of the basis of, our thinking in terms of protection initially. And so we thought, well, instead of just the area around these lakes, can we screen minor watersheds, which incorporates maybe 2, 3, 4, 5 lakes, not just one lake. We have 125 in our county, as shown here. And this was kind of a question. I'm just going to jump back, because we were really wrestling with this idea of scale. And when we talk about watersheds, well, what are we talking about? Are we talking about the Mississippi Basin level? That's one big watershed. Are we talking about the upper Mississippi Basin, getting down a little bit? Are we talking maybe some of the tributaries, like the Pine River? That's a Huck 8 watershed. And that was kind of the scale that we were wrestling with, really, that major watershed level. And we were part of 5 major watersheds, as it kind of shows on this slide. And we just felt that a local county level, that was unmanageable. We weren't significant parts of 3 of them, especially, and the other 2, we were sharing the watershed with neighboring counties. And so we thought, well, let's zoom in one more to that minor watershed, of which I think there's 5,000 in the state maybe, and see what that gets us. So how do we take a first run at these minor watersheds? You know, we recognize that there's some of these larger lakes are within these minors. About 25% of these miners have a lake with water quality data from this large lake assessment project that we did. We also recognize that there's 8 of these minor watersheds that have part of the Mississippi River flowing through them, and there's a little bit more structure and organization along the Mississippi River that has some data that can support the project. 37% are other lakes and rivers that we've identified locally as being significant, whether they're trout lakes, Cisco lakes, wild rice lakes. But that still leaves 42% of the miners without any kind of data that we can use. So that was our problem. How do we handle the rest of these miners? And again, just to kind of make this a little bit easier to understand, maybe we said, okay, let's start with this protection model that was in those assessment reports, the public lands, the wetlands, And let's see if we can apply this to a minor watershed, recognizing that at the other end of the spectrum we have some developed areas, ag pasture, haylands, but there's a lot of our county that we know is private forest and is upland. Let's kind of dive into that and see where that breaks down. This is just a quote, policy statement by the National Association of State Foresters. Water and all its uses and permutations is by far the most valuable commodity that comes from the forest land that we manage, assist others to manage, and or regulate. And, forests, I think, are a huge part of north central Minnesota and just nationwide as a resource. Whole departments have been created around protecting our state and national forests. So this part of our area we wanted to make sure was included in our water plan. And where those two meet, where the forest land and the water come together, is kind of the sweet spot for some of our implementation projects that we think can make a difference. We're not going to ignore the other half here. We're still going to, apply best management practices on our urban areas and our agricultural areas. But really, it kind of comes down to that riparian zone. So feeding into our water plan, we had some data from the state, driven by local policy, and it really fed into our priorities. Where are we going to focus on? What are we going to focus on in that riparian sweet spot? And hopefully have a habitat benefit as well as water quality. Some of the reasons that we did this, again, Dan mentioned most of these lakes and streams are not impaired. We felt the major watershed was too broad, and we'll show you in a sec here some of the differences that popped out at the minor watershed level. Again, in our situation and others in our area, a lot of these minor watersheds did not have data, so we needed to come up with a model to kind of determine that. Where we don't work is probably as important as where we actually do work, especially with limited funding. How are you going to best prioritize those dollars? And habitat, as Dan mentioned, the amendment provided funds for habitat and clean water and parks and trails. Bringing those together is an important concept in the state of Minnesota. And we must be able to communicate this and demonstrate that we're making progress toward a goal and we're not just spending dollar after dollar after dollar. When is enough enough? So when we apply some of this this model to a map, now we're getting into the fun part of the talk here. This is, again, kind of a compilation of the public ownership, those public waters, wetlands. We also added conservation easements to the map. We're going to go through three examples later that kind of touch on three different parts of the county. One is a very lake-driven system, the top of the watershed. The next one is kind of an urban miner with a big lake, and then at the bottom is kind of a stream-based agricultural setting. These three particular examples, none of them had a lot of protected lands when we ran the model. I mentioned some of the factors that we had at our disposal. We had some data from DNR. They had just completed a study that looked at land use in terms of the watershed of some of the major fishing lakes in the state of Minnesota and how did land use changes affect those lakes. And they found that the more land use disturbance, it often had a negative impact on the downstream lake. Kind of broke the state in half. North part of the state had a lot of lakes that they classified as in vigilance or protection mode. Generally less than 25% land use disturbance. Those were still in good shape in terms of fishing and fishing habitat. And then in the southern part of the state, there might be some restoration or enhancement that may be needed to bring those lakes back to a healthy status. So we decided, well, let's add that land cover disturbance to our model and see what that did. And this really shows the differences in our county from north to south. North is very much lake forested area. South is, agricultural, farm fields, that sort of thing. Doesn't mean that it's bad down there. It just means that it's been disturbed, and it's a factor that we wanted to recognize in our model. Again, these three examples that we'll talk about, one of them, in particular, in the green up north, Lake Oswin and McKee, very, very much a healthy, intact watershed, low land disturbance, and you can see the other two kind of go down from there. And then we also wanted to add in the water quality trends that we talked about from our large lake assessments. What does that tell us for those minor watersheds? And so this was kind of the three legs of our protection model. And again, this was never really been done anywhere in the state. And we thought, well, we know we have these three good sources of data. Let's just see what happens. We also applied this kind of a little bit broader as well beyond just our county and looked at some of the Mississippi Headwaters Board areas. There's eight counties that are part of a joint powers board for the first 400 miles of the Mississippi, and so we wanted to include them as well. We threw this all in the hopper. I know this kind of gets detailed. We're not going to go through it, but the key to this slide is we sorted out our minor watersheds into four categories. Vigilance, the dark green, were the watersheds that we felt, you know what, they're in good shape. There's a lot of protected lands there. There's minimal disturbance. Maybe we don't have to focus as much on those watersheds. Protection, just the next step down. Again, generally low land use disturbance. There could be some risk factors, but in good shape, all in all. The yellow, kind of on that border, and then the enhanced and the pink was areas that really could be into that restoration category. When we put this all together, this is kind of what we came up with. It really highlights a few things. In particular, the one example, Serpent Lake, that's circled in black, that's shaded out into pink, and that's again kind of an urban area that we really were kind of surprised because the watershed around it wasn't too bad, but we dug a little deeper and found there's some urban stormwater issues directly feeding into the lake. And I think at this point too, I'm going to mention we did kind of make a handout or a poster series to kind of showcase this that we'll hand out to you folks as well, so you can kind of take this back home with you. Maybe I'll transition.
So Mitch has talked a lot about the model, and focusing a lot on those three factors of what's protected, basically permanent or long-term protection. That's what part one, as he mentioned, leg one of the stool, and then part two is land cover disturbance, and then part three is existing water quality data. But that we have things to be aware of or to be mindful of other than declining trends in major lakes, for instance. And so, and that would be outstanding resources. And this is where I think one of the big things we really learned here was maybe you assess at the major watershed level. And for round purposes, what we mean by that is Minnesota has 81 major watersheds. The state's 84,000 square miles. Nice, easy math. And so there's 87 counties. I like that kind of math. So major watersheds and counties in Minnesota average 1,000 square miles. And so maybe we assess at that level because it's a big state and we've got to get around the whole state with these referendum dollars and ramping up our data in 10 or 12 years. But there's a lot more to the world and to water than just that. And that is our outstanding resources. And Jeff coined the term trump cards. So maybe, yeah, you don't have a declining trend here, but you happen to have a 1,000-acre wild rice lake. What's that worth? Well, in terms of vegetative diversity, habitat quality, cultural significance, and so on, it's very significant. And wild rice is very sensitive to degradation and decline, as it has across the lake states, very significantly. And so, I don't know if there's another county in the world that has the density of wild rice lakes that Crow Wing County has. There might be. I'm not sure. It would be right up there. Yeah, Becker County in western Minnesota might as well. At any rate, this is a very rich area in terms of wild rice resources. It's also very rich in terms of Cisco lakes. And Cisco, are a member of the salmon family that are one of those canaries in the coal mine, that if you have Cisco in your lake, boy, the large game fisheries such as the walleye, the muskie, the northern that most folks like to focus on, definitely do better in lakes that have Cisco. Because with that salmon lineage, they have high oil content, and so it's just easier to maximize fish in those game species, fish size in those game species, if you have Cisco. So we want to know what fisheries is telling us. DNR Fisheries gave us some great input on, hey, you guys want to watch out for your Cisco lakes. These are really important, very high water quality indicators. These are different. And so what we're starting to figure out here is we've kind of been treating all our minor watersheds like they're the same. Boy, I mean, nothing could be further from the truth. They're incredibly different. And our job is to find the differences. And so one of the differences is wild rice. One of them might be a major lake that's an important recreation lake, like Mitch mentioned at Serpent Lake, with a declining trend. That's different than the lakes around it because they don't have declining trends. Or it might be something else like trout or something of that nature. So we came up with the concept of trump cards that we also wanted to add in addition to declining trends. Okay, now we're going to move into a few examples. If we can't implement, you know what, what's the point, you know, of all this planning if we can't implement? We don't plan to plan, we plan to implement. And so this is an example of a really interesting, complicated little project, but I'll try to do the one-minute version if I can. In this part of Minnesota, we have, in Crow Wing County, we have this very large, where am I? There it is. We have this very, in green here, this light tan or yellow color, we have 53,000 acres of a military training facility. It's the only large military training facility in the state. It's 17 miles of continuous shoreline on the Mississippi River on the east side. And only in America could subdivisions come in 100 years after the military's been training there and shut down the military training. But that's happened in the country. So Department of Defense, the National Guard, and so on are very interested in controlling development adjacent to these training facilities. That's why you see the red line outside the facility there, that's a 3-mile buffer. So ACUB stands for Army Compatible Use Buffer, and because we had this need here and Department of Defense had some funds, we've been working with them, DNR, Nature Conservancy, and other partners, especially local government, to try to offer a very well-funded easement program for willing landowners that would like to coordinate with, if they just wanted to farm anyway, this is prime potato ground here, irrigated potatoes. If they just wanted to farm potatoes anyway, why not take a 50% payment that extinguishes your development rights but retains all your other property rights? So as you can see here, the red indicates completed parcels, and the pink areas are interested landowners. So we have 300 landowners on the waiting list, and we have spent, I think it's $25 million so far in getting this far. Well, I'm going to introduce real quickly the conservation toolbox, another concept we use. Just I like to try to take continuums and boil big complicated stuff down to simple principles that people can follow, because we've said all along our goal here isn't to wow the experts, our goal is to bring the county commissioners with, if we can. They're the policy setters at that local level in the area of land use. If they understand what we're talking about, we have a chance. If we talk over their heads, we don't, we're done. So we try to come up with concepts like this in the area of these watersheds here. It was mainly, there's some fee title acquisition done for wildlife areas. It's mostly purchased easements. And then there's lots of general advice and assistance that goes out there, cost share type things as well. So that's where we've been operating in this particular minor watershed, thanks to the concern over the training facility there. So this is a 500-acre easement the state of Minnesota has, I think, 7,000 easements, something like that, 6,000 or 7,000 conservation easements, and about, I think, 200,000 acres, 250,000 acres of land. I would put this easement up against any of them in the whole state. 550 acres, two complete lakes, deep lakes, outstanding fisheries, and 1.75 miles of both sides of the river. So this is the example of the type of jewel we look for. Talk to the landowner, and it's up to them. They're holding all the cards. If they're interested in conservation, then they engage in the program. So now we're bringing this moving the needle concept again from water planning over here and working it with this military training project, bringing the two together. So you see on the map at the bottom there, the light yellow areas are conservation easements that have been completed. The green is fee title. And so we started with a water quality risk factor like this of 13, which is high risk here. Doesn't mean water quality is bad, but there is a high risk that it will become bad. Okay? The conservation easement thing, you can see that score go from 0 to 24, thanks to the Department of Defense, largely. And we've got a whole color change in our indicator there in terms of reduced water quality risk. So that's the concept right there. Then we convene a local technical committee of state and local nonprofit folks, and we say, well, what would a good goal for this minor watershed be? We've got 125 minor watersheds we can't spend forever here. Maybe 45 would be a good goal. If we could move this one to the right up to 45, and why should we keep working there? According to the Forest Service, which looked at all the source water streams in the northeastern 20 states in a study, the Nokasippi River ranked 7th out of Minnesota's 81 rivers for source water significance and risk. So that's the reason we probably better have a little more due diligence there.
Serpent Lake was the second of those three kind of examples that we talked about. And this is, you know, one of the things that we did at the county is we measured the impervious surfaces or the hard surfaces on all the riparian lots all around some of these lakes. And Serpent had the highest. There's some literature out there that suggests once you get up to 12-15% impervious on your shoreline lots, water quality begins to decline. And we'd seen that decline in Serpent Lake. And so using the water plan and some of the long-term data that we have, our Soil and Water District was actually able to get a grant to significantly improve some of the stormwater management on Serpent Lake. In our model, again, this is an enhanced. That was that pink watershed that kind of stuck out. And the only way in our model to really move that from enhanced to an enhanced protection, you know, is really to work on the risk factors, you know, that stormwater management piece. You know, we're not going to be able to buy a lot of land in an urban setting in terms of protection. There's not a lot of easements that we can apply, but in this case, you know, we can really do some good stormwater management and hopefully move that out of the enhanced to the enhanced protection. Different set of tools to get there, like I mentioned, a lot of grants, a lot of working with landowners, identifying specific problems in that watershed. The last one was up north, you know, watershed in great shape, but it had a risk classification of yellow, of that kind of the third of the fourth tier down. And why was that? Again, you know, this map shows it had low protected land. So in other words, not a lot of public land, not a lot of wetlands in this watershed. But what it did have going for it, as you can see in the picture, was a beautiful forest land. And lots of it. 92% of the watershed was still in forested condition. And so, you know, our model indicates, yeah, there's risk here, but there's also opportunity. Especially when you look at how much of this, you know, like I said, how much of this watershed is in a private forested upland, there's a lot. It was probably number one in the county. So that is where we're going to focus. Those are the types of tools that we're going to focus on, especially in light of all the development that this area has seen in the last 10 to 15 years. So there, just because there's low risk, it doesn't mean that there's not opportunities there. Just want to throw out, we did make 125 different maps for all of our minor watersheds to really help county commissioners and landowners kind of see what's going on in their watershed. And with that, I think I'll turn it over to Jeff to kind of close us out.
So the first part of the analysis and the model looked at the landscape. And as we've gained some knowledge over time, we've had the ability to do some, gather some more data, much more data as a result of the amendment. We started to think about, what about the lakes? You know, what can we build? You know, one of the concepts, again, one of the simple concepts we've tried to get across to the county commissioners and citizens and resource managers, for that matter, sort of three things you can do with the land. You know, you can buy it either outright or through an easement process, get rid of some of the risk, or you can manage it, and some of that is through information education, maybe enforced management through some of the ordinances and land use controls, or you can improve it, and that's where the cost share and that's where some of the programs come in. And the initial swing at the model looked a lot at that acquisition part, and then using available funds for thinking about how to improve it. And say, we looked at the lake screening. That was the first step. That was a pretty reasonably crude exercise, looking at lake transparency over time. That was the most that was the most information we had. Many lakes had some phosphorus information, not really enough or a long enough data set to think about having a trend. Big Trout Lake is one of the trump cards that Crow Wing County has. It's a major lake. It's a major recreational lake. Oh yeah, it's got lake trout. There aren't very many lakes anywhere, particularly in the state of Minnesota, that is close to a pretty major population center that has lake trout available. That's a sensitive water. It had a long-term decline in water quality. Shorter term, maybe that's starting to tilt a little bit. There seems to be no trend over the last few years. Again, you've still got all of these lakes to think about how to sort. We've sorted into three piles, but now we need to think about how to sort those out a little bit. So then how do we think about going to the water, going to the lake, and thinking about how to get that that risk concept in that as well as the watershed, or bring it back there. And so working with folks from the DNR, Department of Natural Resources, Paul Radomski was a big driver in the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, Steve Heisgree, Pam Anderson, thinking about trying to synthesize a way to compare lake to lake. Lakes are all different. They're different depths, they're different shapes, they're different. They exist in different landscapes. Some have outlets, some have inlets, some are just groundwater fed, and all those things are influence that lake water quality. How do we think about trying to come to some common way to compare those? And so, looking at retention time, that's one of the major factors in lake water quality, and total phosphorus loading coming from the watershed. Thinking about ways, there's sophisticated models that can get you there. There's some simple models that can get you there as far as estimating that loading. And then thinking about what decrease in transparency might occur if you were to add 100 pounds of phosphorus to the lake. That seemed like a number that we could put a scale to. For a landowner, that's 4 bags of fertilizer. That equals about 100 pounds of phosphorus. How much is that lake predicted to get less clear when you add that there? So that's a sensitivity. How sensitive is that lake to that phosphorus enrichment? But then, what's the significance of that lake? We've got 550 in the county. They aren't all the same. Some have a higher use. Some exist in those vigilance watersheds where there may be a small lake that's sensitive, but there isn't very much risk in changing it. So you look at the phosphorus sensitivity, which we have calculated. We look at the watershed disturbance, which we have from the land use work that Crow Wing County did. We can look at the lake size. Generally, lake size is larger lakes are more important to folks. There's more shoreline. Dan talked about, you know, shoreline values of $1,500 to $2,000 an acre. Big Trout Lake, which was the previous example, it's about $4,000 a foot. So there's a constituency, and there's a reason that folks pay attention to the water quality in lakes. Current water quality, and then proximity to the water quality standard. Minnesota has a variable standard across the state in water quality. to determine impairments or not. And you put those things together and you come up with a sensitivity significance. And a team from the DNR and the MPCA put this together and basically ranked about 2,000 lakes in the state as to sensitivity significance. What's that look like on a watershed scale? Now, this is the Pine River watershed. Crow Wing County is sort of down in this part of the watershed. This is Pelican Lake in Crow Wing County. This is the chain of lakes. Whitefish chain of lakes is a major recreation source, and Big Trout Lake is this one up at the top here. We'll come back to that in a minute. But you can then look again at sensitivity significance across that major watershed, four or five counties involved, and get a common understanding of where we don't work, maybe as important as where we do work, and start to bring that together. So then where to start? You know, we have this sensitivity significance. We want to add an X factor. Go back to that original information. Do we have a declining transparency trend? Do we have some other factor? Is it an outstanding resource? And that starts to lead toward the priorities. We're developing a phosphorus target for that lake protection. We can start to get this into some sort of numerical comparison. The total maximum daily load in the impaired waters world gives us all sorts of numbers that we can shoot for targets and very precise. Up until Crow Wing County started to do this, and in many cases across the state, you'd look at a grant application to do work in a watershed, and the words were some variation of, water quality is still good and we want to keep it that way. It's a great concept, but it doesn't necessarily sell very well with legislators, decision makers, and citizens when you're saying, why are you spending this money here? And what are we going to get out of it? And they're looking for a little bit more precise answers out of that. So we can look at the total phosphorus concentrations and develop a target based on the existing data that's out there. We have a lot of data in the system, and we can do that. We can target the total phosphorus loads and load reductions to meet that target from the statistical models that are out there. That's important. We can start to think about this in our watershed restoration and protection strategies. You'll hear more about that this afternoon from Shannon Lothammer, maybe from Steve too, in terms of a way to put all that information together on these major watershed scales and provide that to the counties. Local watershed management plans, or local water management plans, counties, as we are transitioning in Minnesota to what we're calling a one watershed, one plan, so that the common elements of information and resource management are spread across counties and go into more of a watershed concept. So that will be one of the next steps over the next few years that we work on. When we talk about Big Trout Lake, water quality standard is up at 30 parts per billion. Now, I don't do a lot of with soils all the time, but as I recall soil tests, they're measured in parts per million. Lakes are a lot more sensitive than soils. You can lose a little bit of phosphorus out of a soil and never miss it. It'll make a big difference in the lake. So the water quality standard in this area is 30 parts per billion. On the far side of that, it's impaired. On the downside, it's not impaired. That's only a binary switch. It doesn't tell you where you've been. It doesn't necessarily tell you where you might be going. So Big Trout Lake, over time, has had a couple of different ways of looking at it. The best year it's ever had under monitoring is 7 parts per billion. And some folks would say, well, that's our target. It can reach that. We should shoot for that. It's had as much as 14. Long-term average is about 11. I think as we went through, the decision was to think about the 75th percentile of that long-term average. We can do some things and shoot for a target of 9 on this lake. Other lakes will be different, but the point is we can come up with a numerical value that we can talk to folks about. So on Big Trout, by the numbers, the color wheel around the lake, that's the impervious surface coverage of each of those lots. There's an audience, and there's a particular lot. If you're a red lot, you're over 15% impervious. there's a contact source that you can go talk to folks about. So the predicted load for this lake is 778 pounds. The target load is 687. We've got to reduce it by 90. Great. How do we do that? Well, we can get a strategy for that. Maintain that existing forest cover. If we maintain that forest cover, we won't increase the load. If we do change the forest cover, manage for that to not increase that phosphorus load to that lake. Along the outside of the lake, there's a highway that's got some curb and gutter. It brings a fairly substantial amount of urbanized stormwater and transportation corridor stormwater into the lake, about 80 pounds a year. We can put some treatment in there and reduce that by about 40. We can do some shoreline management plans, stormwater plans, about a pound and a half each. So we can actually start to quantify what people's contribution will be to this protecting this lake that they have an interest in. Costs, some of these costs, you know, the large lake screening, we're able to do almost 200 lakes for about $180,000. Crow Wing County did the minor watershed screening most of Mitch's time over a year or so, $20,000. The Mississippi River screening, that took a little bit more effort. It was a longer area and a little bit more data intensive. Total of about $260,000 to get to some of this sort of information. But it's led to some interesting things. I think the large lake screening has sort of led to this statewide phosphorus sensitivity led by the DNR and PCA, and that'll start showing up in these water plans. Mississippi Headwaters counties are now starting to adopt this lake screening and minor watershed screening proposition so that they'll have a common understanding and a common communication channel. And then, again, not a lot of cities up here, but the ones that are the highest impervious surface contribution to the Mississippi River. Brainerd, Baxter, Bemidji, Grand Rapids, you know, not huge cities in the grand scheme of the world. But in this particular watershed, in this particular basin, they're significant contributors, different than the rest of the watersheds. And so we've looked at starting to do sort of urban stormwater analysis where where some cost benefits can be assigned to doing that stormwater management. And with that, I'll quit. And if we've got time for questions, we can do that.